when I first agreed to make this little presentation, I had hoped that it would be in the village center where there would be an instrument, that we could talk about some of the problems of music and worship. And Walt Bowman offered to have a piano brought over, but I think that was a little presumptuous, and maybe what I would have to say in that area can be saved till another time. Now, if you are in any way bothered by the change here and would like to go see the star slides, by all means, feel free to do so. I would rather just visit with you a little bit and talk about worship in general and attitudes of worship and some of the problems in worship. Many years I started giving a little lecture on an article that appeared in the National Organ magazine, The Diapason, which carried in it a sort of facetious, and yet maybe not so foolish, an article called The Eternal Triangle. The Eternal Triangle. First of all, the pastor speaks. And he says, my organist has absolutely no liturgical sense whatsoever. He thinks his prelude and anthem and so on are more important than my sermon. I'll elaborate on that after a little bit. And then the organist speaks. And almost identically he says, my pastor has no liturgical sense whatsoever. I know what a triad is, and he doesn't. And then the forgotten man speaks, the man in the pew. And his only complaint is, why can't we ever sing the old familiar hymns? Now, some of that's a little bit facetious, and yet maybe it's often more true than we realize. My point actually here is to try to call your attention to the fact that all three are positively involved in the whole idea of worship. What would the man be in the pew be without hymns and liturgy to sing or a sermon to listen to? What would the man in the pulpit be without hymns and music and liturgy? And what would the organist be without the man in the pew and the man in the pulpit? Now, maybe this is far-fetched, but maybe not. I think we have to recognize, first of all, that all three are humans, with all the foibles and characteristics of average people, if there is such a thing. I'm not sure that you could set up a characteristic of the average pastor. I don't think you could do that with the description of an average organist. And I'm quite sure that that would not apply to the average worshiper in the pew each morning. And the point I'm trying to make is that all three are involved in this nebulous sort of thing of what makes worship what it ought to be. I think it's a frightening responsibility for the pastor to recognize that he is in charge of worship, with all that that means. Not only that everything should be done decently and in order, but he needs to know his music, too. I don't know how well an organist would play a service if he didn't have some idea of what it was all about and what people were trying to achieve in this whole area of worship. And the poor man in the pew is, as I said, the forgotten person. He has nothing to say about it. He's like story of Christ, you know, talking about the poor you always have with you. And the poor man is subjected to all kinds of things and has had nothing to say about it at all. For 40-some years, I've been involved in church music and worship. And some of the comments I make may be a little bit far-fetched, and yet they have been actual experiences. I don't know of a single Lutheran seminary that does a complete job in training their pastors in worship and all that involves. For many years, I taught liturgy at our seminary in Rock Island. I had, for several years, 40 men 1 hour a week. Now, where do you begin with 40 men 1 hour a week? In trying to encourage them to understand what the problems of the musicians are in church, and there are many of them, or try to get him to realize what are the problems of the man in the pew, and there are many of them. And I complained to the dean of the seminary at that time, and he brushed it off and said, well, now, one of these days they're going to come and ask for special courses in scout leadership. And they're going to want to run special courses in Robert's Rules of Order, so that our pastors will be able to run their annual meetings well. And maybe there's a point, but the idea, it seems to me, that the pastor has to recognize that there is a special training, a special ability to be a good church musician. And the organist, too, has to recognize that the pastor has many problems and that he should be sympathetic to them. I think very often, and I'm not generalizing, but I've been here now for 18 summers, and I'm overwhelmed. Please now, if there are clergymen in the audience, don't be disturbed. Overwhelmed by the number of pastors who want to lead singing. As a matter of fact, the number of them who have collapsible batons in their briefcases. They want to lead the singing. Well, that annoys me no end. I don't need anybody to lead the singing. If as an organist I can't handle it myself, I'm not going to do it secondhand through somebody's beating time. One of the most excruciating moments up here was one vesper where we sang, Now Thank We All Our God. Pretty solid chorale, you know, and people like to sing that. And the man stopped me at the end of the first stanza and said, Now, will you play quietly while I read the text? Well, I had a problem. Now, what should I do? Should I keep the tempo of the chorale, or should I try to follow his leading of the text? And I thought afterwards, really, it was an insult, because people had a right to sing the text, O may this bounteous God, to sing it rather than listen to it. And I almost got hysterical, because what should I do? Shall I hurry up when he hurries up and ruin the good solid chorale? Shall I slow down when he does? It was ridiculous. He has special problems, of course. And really, I think handling worship with all it involves, he gets special training in theology and preaching, but the music of the service is not presented to him. There may be very sensitive pastors, and I'm sure there are, but if they are going to be thoroughly equipped to understand the problems of liturgical music and the music of the service, that is an impossible demand for them to know that too. And then you say, well, what about the organist? Yeah, they have special problems too. And remember, these are all human people. If he has had good training, he has developed a certain amount of facility. And it's absolutely amazing what these young organists can do in terms of facility. But the point is that it is very seldom applied to the demands of a worship service. They can play Messiaen and Bach and anybody you name it. And they can't play a hymn so you can sing it. it isn't taught generally. And these sweet young things that come out of our schools of music with all this fabulous equipment, they will say, oh, gee, if I only had a tracker action, I could really play. And they've missed the point, because I like to remind them, how many preludes do you play in a service? One. How many anthems do you do? Well, one generally. An offertory, yes. How many hymns do you play? And if you don't play hymns so that people can sing, you've missed the point. Sure, I'm stimulated by a fine rendition of a Bach prelude and fugue. But if I can't sing the hymns, I'm ready to close my hymnal. I want to participate. And isn't worship participation? Well, now how are we going to overcome this? Well, look at the poor man in the pew. He has his likes and his dislikes. And he criticizes both the pastor and the organist, of course. Those are prime targets. You know. But if he can't satisfy his urge to participate, he has a logical complaint. And you hear so many times, oh, he plays too fast, I can't sing that first. Or she plays so slow, I simply can't do that. And that's true. And nobody, and I know there are several organists here, no organist will agree that so-and-so is the proper tempo for a hymn. Will you take your pulse a minute? Hold your thumb on your pulse. Now, we may not agree, because some may be slow and some fast. But along about Bach's time, take, for instance, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. It was recommended that each beat or note in that chorale should correspond to three pulses. What would you do with that?
I'm worried about you. Your pulse is too slow.
Yeah. You have to get up and exercise a while and get that moving.
Get it moving just a little bit faster.
There's no standard there in terms of fastness and slowness. But I want to present the idea that it is not always that it's only too fast or too slow. Organists often tend to be erratic within a certain tempo. And at the same time, it simply must not be cranked out at a certain metronomic pointing. Can I ask you, do you know what the difference between time and rhythm is? Which one is measurable? Time. And, you know, some hymnals, and I think the red hymnal had something to say about that, too. They would say, not too fast. That's a big help, isn't it? Thoughtfully. My heavens, would you sing any hymn and not be thinking about it? We do, of course. Slowly, with movement. Yeah. There's no way of measuring that. The hymnal has a sense of humor there. I think the measure for all organists is this. If your congregation sings well, you're playing well. Any choir sings as well as they are led. Any congregation sings as well as they are urged by the organist. Now, where do you learn that? And I can understand that there are many problems involved. Now, many of our pastors are sensitive to church music. And yet, I have the feeling that, really, you boys had better concentrate on one or the other. Would I dare to criticize the theology of my pastor as an organist? No way. And yet, I have been told, you better play that a little fast because it has seven stanzas. We've got to get all those seven in, you know? What if we were used to the old German chorales with 12, 14 stanzas? And in many cases, they stood during the whole service. That's a little bit difficult, isn't it? I have the old-fashioned notion that as far as pastors are concerned, they ought sometime to go with their organist to a workshop. Go with them and find out what some of those problems are. Now, there's a certain person in this room who will remember what I'm talking about. Many years ago, I was called to Milwaukee to speak on worship at a pastoral conference. Well, the session opened with a long, long, long read article by one of the pastors about worship. And then my session was to come next. Well, now there were about 20 pastors and 4 musicians there. Now you say, well, where are the musicians? Well, people, let's recognize that 90% of our church musicians are part-time. And they have jobs to do. And it is not possible for them to attend some of these sessions. I used to tease my pastor at home because I played at this church. I had 2 services in the morning and I had 1 in the evening. I had 2 choir rehearsals in the week. And on Monday he would say, well, now I take the day off. I had to go back to teach on Monday morning. Well, all but one of these pastors left this second session, which was to talk about the music of the liturgy, and disappeared into some room where they were going to have a discussion on whether or not it was proper to serve communion to people who had to stand up. Well, I suppose that's important. But I like to think that sometime they ought to find out what some of the problems of the musicians are. And people, I wonder if the editors and our commissions on worship realize how many of our church musicians are volunteers? These fine, dedicated people who serve for nothing. They have to buy their own organ music. And anybody who buys organ music these days knows that that's not a cheap item. And I suppose because I had the combination of organ and choir, I was not faced with a problem of a conflict that is often true between the organist and the choir director. Now, who generally gets the best salary? The choir director. Everything is provided for him. The music is bought. The organist has to buy her own music, and she has to be there all the time. Now, the choir director could leave after the anthem, and some of them do. But these poor people simply cannot afford, in their willingness to help, to go on and on, paying out financially the demands for organ music. And I have great sympathy with them too, because, for instance, if there's a vacancy in your church in the organ desk, doesn't make any difference whether it happens to be a piano or a Hammond organ or a marvelous Cassavant organ. Many of these people are part-time and they can't get off to get to these meetings. And by and large, my experience with workshops is this fact. The little organist in a small church is absolutely petrified by what is presented in a music workshop. They can't begin to do what is asked of them, to play all the Bach preludes and fugues and transpose and all the rest of it. We had an occasion here this spring. One very fine person had been playing before I came and she said, I can't play Praise to the Lord, the Almighty, in the key of F. I'm used to playing it in the key of G. I can't do it. There are problems. Now, somewhere, we have to get pastors to recognize that, and probably more important, the man in the pew, to recognize what those problems are. And if those three units in worship pull in three different directions, we've lost it. There must be some understanding of the problems of the pastor, and Lord knows there are many of them. The organist has many of them too. And the poor man in the pew, he is just overwhelmed with everything that's going on. Now, I want to say something about choir people in the first place. They are some of the most wonderful people in the world. The regularity of attendance, of many rehearsals and extra rehearsals for festivals and so on. Why do they come? They must get something. And bless them, they, in a particular way, probably get more out of that coming Sunday morning service because they've been a part of a preparation. If you have a good director who selects his anthem that is appropriate for the day, says something about style, and I touch a sore spot here, is understanding enough to point out that an anthem has something beside style of music. You will notice in your hymnal that the text, the assignment of a text to whoever is listed first. The tune is listed second. Now, I have run into people in choir schools and so on who will say, now, don't let your words interfere with the music. Well, let's take out all the words and just sing la la la. We can have marvelous crescendo and well-tapered diminuendos. We can have contrast, we can have flow, we can have exciting rhythms. But what is the tune written for many times? It's based on that author's reaction to a text, and we ought to give them some credit. And I don't see how you can miss the point in choral work that choirs sound better if they know what they're talking about in terms of text. It does something to the sound. It's just unbelievable how exacting choir people and choir directors can be. Oh, now wait a minute, you have a dotted quarter there. Well, that's fine. But if they put every dotted quarter, every half note, every diminuendo, every crescendo in its proper place and have said nothing about the text, what have you got? Only half of what you should have. I know it's very difficult to know where to stop. Now, say for instance here at Holden, we have two rehearsals a week. And what can you do? If you present a perfectly performed, and I use that intently, anthem without any reference to text, you have missed half of it. I would rather that they would sing a wrong note sometime and be aware of what they're talking about. It sounds in their voice. It's absolutely impossible to disassociate the kind of vocal sound they make from the content or the meaning of the word. Choirs sound better if they know what they're singing about. So does the pastor when he chants. So does the man in the pew when he sings. Give him a chance to sing text. Give him a chance. We have a problem here, you know, because the poor man in the pew is not the dull, insensitive person that many of us would like to make him out to be. He has lived life in many, many associations. Some of these things hit him hard. He's looking for something. And if he doesn't understand it, it's probably because he hasn't been taught. And I think the educational demands and responsibilities of our churches these days are of primary importance. People are asking, are begging for help in understanding some of these things. And somehow we miss the point. I remember in our church in Moline, when I first started there, we had a committee. The organist and choir director, that was the same person. The president of the choir, the pastor, and then also the man who taught liturgics in our seminary. We met once a month to select anthems for the month. And this dear man in the seminary, he was fine, he was sensitive, but he would go into ecstasy. Oh, here is this beautiful Brahms motet. Let's sing it on such and such a Sunday. The choir couldn't begin to do it. All out of reason. I think sometimes we are more slaves to style of music than text. And if what we sing on a Sunday morning as an anthem doesn't sound like we meant it, the person listening is going to miss it. He's going to miss it. There are so many, many angles to this, and I just keep coming back to the idea that those of you who preach, those of you who play, and those of you who are in the pew ought to get together on this thing. It's everybody's responsibility. For goodness sakes, if you like something that has been sung on a Sunday morning, tell them so. If you don't like it, tell them so. If the organist plays a hymn in with a treatment that is uncomfortable, say so. Now, many organists are just concerned about the facility, and in the many workshops I've had, some dear little person will come up and say, well, now, my organ teacher said that if a note is repeated, you must break that note and start again. And I do that, but my people don't follow me. Well, I think in music, as in a lot of other things, you have to learn rules and learn when to break them. For instance, on a very cold Sunday morning in January, people have been out late the night before, and they're really in no mood to sing. It's my responsibility to make them, to play in such a way that they are carried along and swept with it. And on Easter Sunday, exactly the opposite is true. Here's a festival, and they go tearing off, and I've got to hold them back. There must be somebody in charge at that point. And of course, as I said, we don't all agree. Going back to the hymnal, what does stately mean? I don't think you can ever play a hymn without knowing its text. And I would suggest that all choir directors practice all the hymns for Sunday on Wednesday night to prepare the choir so that at least they know something about what's going to happen. And I think every organist without fail must practice every hymn for every Sunday. Because in so doing, he might see that, well, now look, that second stanza has a different content. And if Bach, the giant organist, reharmonized every stanza because of its text, we ought to give some attention to what we're playing in terms of the meaning of the words we're about to sing. Sometimes it's really kind of a discouraging thing because there's so many, many angles to this sort of thing. And I feel sorry for the man in the pew because here we come with a whole new set of liturgy. And he's supposed to assimilate that, you know, and take part of it and make it go. He may not like it, but he didn't have anything to say about it in the first place. And I have a strong feeling that the man who worships is often there for a reason, and his needs ought to be met. And I will never understand why hymnal commissions must be made up of clergymen and musicians. Why isn't a farmer asked, what are your needs in worship? Or a school teacher, what do you need in worship? Or a factory worker, They are the people with whom we work. Their needs are the needs we need. They are the ones that need help. Remember, too, and I'm being a little sarcastic here, that in most cases, unless the church is very large, there are no retirement funds for church musicians. One year in our church at an annual meeting, they decided that they ought to have a time study made of several areas. This was under the suggestion of a high official in John Deere, you know, the implement. Well, now let's see. The pastor should be given so many hours for this sort of thing. He has to spend so many hours in the office every day. We will allow him so many hours for visitation. And he must have so many hours for sermon preparation. And then they talked about the janitor. Well, that's easy. He goes to work at 8 and quits at 4. The office secretary, the same way. She goes to work at 8 and quits at 4, and with an hour off for lunch. Then they came to the organist. Well, they didn't quite not do that. Because I think he realized that some occasions you have festival music to prepare, and that takes more time, as is the case with sermons on special occasions. But they thought, well, maybe so many hours a week you could allow the organist. Well, I objected. I just didn't see that was right at all. Sometimes, as an organist, I can, and I suppose it's true with the pastor too, you can rely on the inspiration of the moment. But unless you have some facility, you hadn't better fool around with that. I was telling a very close friend of ours about this hassle on our annual meeting. And he happened to be from Sweden, has a very strong accent. And he said, why don't you put a meter on the organ? And you put in a quarter and play until that's over, and then you quit. That's the only kind of thing that a production manager in John Deere would understand. He wouldn't realize that sometimes you're really anxious and have been for months of playing a certain prelude that you really have to sweat with. You spend a lot of extra time. It just doesn't make sense. But he didn't understand, as a man in the pew, the problems of the pastor or the organist. And I would like to think that somehow our churches should come to the point where they recognize that they simply cannot rely on good services of an organist who has had no training. They may be lucky, but you know, they'll say, well, so-and-so's daughter plays the piano, she should be able to play the organ. And they get what they get. And then these poor people, as I said before, I remember our organist in a small church in Iowa got $50 a year, and she was there always, always, always. If they had had workshops at that time, she couldn't have possibly have afforded to go there. We should pay the expenses of our church musicians to go there. And we should, by all means, insist that the pastor go there too. Because there are insights that are necessary in this whole area of music and worship that are beyond his training and background. He may be sensitive, but he ought to see what some of those problems are. We participate in a service if we know what it's about, and that's a big order. Somewhere, I think it's in the Psalms, it says, praise the Lord with understanding. Now, how are we going to get that? Parish education, Sunday school, confirmation, pretty inadequate most of the time. And why is the trend so strong these days to have study sessions between our services? They're not always successful, because sometimes people who complain the most don't come to those. You know, there's coffee being served in the lounge, you know, they can't miss that. So you can't very well force them, but at least it's being offered to them. We have problems, you know, in many areas. There's a good deal of confusion about these days about confirmation, communion, and I don't think many people really understand what those are all about. If they did, they wouldn't be so sure that communion services must be hurried because the bishop cafeteria line gets too long. I've got to be there. Well, that's the wrong reason. Somehow, we have to get our people to understand what, no, not how, but why do we do certain things in worship on Sunday morning? Why is this a good thing to know? And the man in the pew could care less if he were told that, well, now, this is early Gregorian music, or this is Baroque music. He doesn't care, really. If he hasn't a way of being able to participate in that, he's lost. And strengthening our worship means somehow for our people to understand why they do something. Why is this in the new worship being replaced by something else? And we never get those explanations. People have to understand that they are being urged to see things in a new light. And you know, the man in the pew, if he dislikes anything at all, it's the idea that he's being improved. He wants to understand what it's all about, and then he can sing his heart out. He can take part with a heart full of meaning. Well, this is full of sarcasm, you know, and yet much of it is true. The demands on the pastor are tremendous. Should he know all the ins and outs of music too? The organist with their intense amount of training, I mentioned once in our annual meeting that, I felt that there should be a certain amount of consideration for salary for church musicians, because I had paid at that time, it was many years ago, $50 for a half an hour organ lesson, and they refused to believe it. Well, there needs to be an equalization there somehow, but the thing I'm most concerned about is that pastors, on their part, try to understand the needs and the responsibilities of the organist. And the organist and the pastor must react together and try to understand that what they offer on a Sunday morning is fulfilling the needs of the man in the pew. I think the most wonderful thing an organist can have is a pastor who is a personal friend. That's wonderful. And that's not often true. There seems to be, for some reason, often a little antagonism in there. And it ought not to be. But for whatever my comments are worth, when you get back to your parishes, see if you can't do some thinking about the eternal God. Try to understand that the pastor has more to do than preach on Sunday morning and visit the sick and so on. And that the organist has many things that they have to do. And don't forget the man in the pew, because if there was no man in the pew, he would be out of business. Now, next week, if there is another session like this, I would like to discuss a little bit about the actual music in the new liturgy. And there are many things that are confusing, and they are very seldom explained. And I would like to do that without being too technical. Because there again, you know, people can sing something if it's familiar. And somehow, we have to open up this new material and explain why it is being used. Why, for instance, the creed is put after the sermon. Why don't we sing amens anymore? I'm old-fashioned, and that's the first reaction I get. Oh, well, now look, you're an old-timer. You know, things are different now. But there are certain basic things in worship that will go on forever and ever. And I have one concern about this constantly adding new material. When are we ever going to have a long tradition of worship? And I don't have to worry about it, I guess, because in another 25 years we'll have a new hymn and we'll start all over again. Okay, I've enjoyed talking to you.